WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is always a fun day here at WGTD when we explore an important issue related to the environment with our good friend Nan Calvert. And she pays her monthly visit to the program today and brings with her a very special guest, namely Monty Osterman, who is with the Wisconsin Land and Water Conservation Association and also chair of the Racine County Land Conservation Committee. And we're going to be finding out today what this term conservation really means at its heart, and especially the whole concept of land conservation and as that plays out and the ways in which this has played out maybe differently now versus once upon a time. A lot to explore. Nan Calvert and Monty Osterman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Glad that you can be here. So, Nan Calvert, tell us about your acquaintance with Monty Osterman and his organization and why you wanted to have this conversation today.
Well, I met Monty quite a number of years ago when he was associated with Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, and we had the Rain Garden Initiative going on. And so, you know, that was years ago, and Monty has gone on to do quite a number of different things. I think Monty is a very well-known person in Racine County and other parts. And I've been trying to get him on the radio for a while, and persistence has finally paid off. and so I'm very happy that he's here to talk about his history with conservation and what he's doing now with Wisconsin Land and Water, and how that impacts everybody for the better.
Before we dig into that story, how are you, Nan, using the term conservation, or how do you want us to understand the term conservation?
I would like people to think about conservation in the sense of relationship with the natural world and how we impact it and how we can begin having a more positive impact on our natural resources, particularly water and soil, and all of the things that require clean water and good soil in order to survive. So those are entire ecosystems. Conservation for a long time was sort of compartmentalized, if you will. So some people worked on water and some people worked on birds and, that sort of thing. But for the last while now, we've begun to think about systems and relationships and how they obviously have always been connected to one another and how they interact with one another and how we have to, that's the way we need to concentrate our efforts and our energies in a systems approach. So I want people to think about conservation as their relationship with natural resources, with the natural world, and how they can have a positive impact to enhance and preserve those.
Very good. Monty Osterman, we're really glad that you can be with us today to help us explore some of these important concepts. Nan was really anxious for me to ask you about kind of your lifelong devotion to the notion of conservation, and that's a great place for us to begin. So just how long a story is this, and how did that story begin? That is your relationship
with
this thing, conservation.
We could be here for days, you know. Incidentally, you remember that when you first came to my house for the rain garden?
Yes, of course.
I still have the rain garden.
Oh, excellent.
It's still
That's
established
wonderful.
And it's working very well. By the way, and this kind of goes to the question of what is conservation, you know. The result, Nan has characterized it very well, but I want to tell you something. I like to look at it as what is the result of conservation, and to me, I use a very simple term. Conservation means, in the end, you use it. Okay, conservation is not sequestering lands and waters and species. It's to inculcate all of those things into your daily life. And the rain garden effort was a very good example of how conservation works on a micro level, at the individual level. In my own home, we stopped getting water in our basement when we put the rain garden in and redirected the water flow that way. So there was a cost savings there, you know. So you use it. You find a way to use it in a responsible manner. So that's how I feel about conservation. In the end, you find a way to use it and use it well. So how did I get here? When I was 18 years old, I grew up in southern Indiana on the Ohio River, so kind of a river rat from way back. Mm. And I went across the river after high school, graduation, and I worked at a Easter Seals camp. And we had hundreds of children and young adults throughout the summer who had multiple disabilities. And we accidentally, with those kids, restored a stream. And we just started working on it and putting things back together with no training, no technical ability, and we sort of got it right. Man, we ended up winning a conservation award. And never even knew that's what we were actually doing. We were just having fun and, you know, creating an activity for the kids. So it lit a fire under me, and which carries through to this day. Oddly enough, I've never done this professionally. It's my passion, and I think it's more effective for me that way, you know. So I ended up in Wisconsin, being involved in many different things in the community, like, you know, things with Nan and Root Pike Wynn. And I ended up on the county board in Racine for a decade. And one of my assignments was to the Land Conservation Committee. And I followed through and gained leadership positions there, getting involved in the statewide association, and then representing our state at the national level. And there's a lot of different layers in between there. And that's kind of how it started. It just sort of developed organically, no pun intended.
I'd love to hear more about, a little bit more about mm-hmm. that project mm-hmm. where this all started, the one where you kind of accidentally did mm-hmm. this. What exactly were you doing at the outset mm-hmm. in terms of this project? I mean, and then how did it end up being, in a sense, this other thing that you hadn't intended?
Yeah, well, in the camp, the camp had been built, and you know, in many different stages over a period of years, and so the result of that build was that the stream was redirected. There was runoff that was unintended for the stream area. There was a lot of erosion issue. There was a lot of deadfall that was a problem there, and it had lost its original stream banks. So we started cleaning it out, you know, just to get some water moving there. And then looking at the topography, we kind of figured out, well, you know, that stream is supposed to be looking like this. And so we started getting some riprap in there and creating some meanders, you know, and like Dave Giordano says, put some wiggles in it. And he loves to put wiggles in streams. And but back then we didn't know that's what we were doing. And it just sort of seemed to naturally occur. It just sort of what naturally our instinct told us to do. And that, but it was that development within the camp area itself that caused the problem. And it started me thinking way back then, you know, we're causing our own problems.
That's for sure. So over the years, you said that this is something you've never exactly done professionally. And does that also mean that you did not pursue any, in a sense, education or training in this?
That is correct. I never had any formal education in conservation or soil and water management resource work. But whenever I've had the opportunity to take a class, to sit and talk with many different people over the years, I've taken that opportunity. I've taken time. I've taken days. I've taken seminars, you know, and have sort of developed an informal education, mostly by experience. And you know, one of the people that I've learned a lot from, Dave Giordano at Root Pike Wind, has been he's phenomenal, as you know. And Nan and that whole group, that Root Pike Wind is one of the most important partners that any county can have for this type of work. And then also Dr. John Skalbeck from Parkside has taught me a lot. Anytime I have a technical question, I go to him. We've been friends forever and met through Root Pike Wind again, and he's been great to learn from.
For those of you just joining us, today is the monthly visit of Nan Calvert, our frequent visitor to the morning show, and she has brought with her today Monty Osterman, who is with Wisconsin Land and Water Conservation Association. What exactly is your role there at the moment?
Well, I am currently chair of the board of the Wisconsin Land and Water Conservation Association. That association is comprised of all the land conservation committee members and land conservation department staff throughout the state. So each county has a department with a committee creating policy and a department head and staff that actually do the work. And they are together as an association. And so I'm on the board and am the elected chairman of the board representing the interests of that association.
Let's find out a little more about the work that they do. And in particular, you just said that they are busy, among other things, with the setting of policy. What kind of policy are we talking about in relation to the tenets of land conservation?
Well, Wisconsin is very unique amongst in the conservation districts throughout the nation. We have a very sophisticated model of what we call conservation delivery. We're involved in something called the SOC, the Standards Oversight Council, is a conglomeration of Wisconsin Land and Water, DNR, Department of Agriculture, Trade, Consumer Protection, DATCAP. And we have some university folks involved, Extension, who look at various issues relating to land and water resource management and come up with standards that are recommended to be followed throughout the state as far as water quality, soil health quality, air quality, environmental impact, and oftentimes we look at economic impact of initiating and implementing those initiatives. So the Standards Oversight Council is one thing that the association is involved in and manages. We also do a something called SITCOM, the Statewide Interagency Training Committee, which comes up with all of the training programs and information on how you do this work. And then, of course, we're involved politically with making sure that the statutes that are in place are being followed and implemented. We're constantly having to talk about the funding mechanisms for the counties. There is Chapter 92.1 in the state statutes that require a minimum level of funding from the state to come through the counties for this conservation work. So that's just a few of the things, you know, that we do. We were actually very involved in last year's or 2 years ago, the Speaker's Task Force on Water Quality. There were meetings around the state, and myself and some of the farmer-led watershed protection groups, staff members, we testified before that committee. And from everything that we've been told, our influence was great, and it resulted in 13 different bills being presented to the legislature, made it through the House, and then 2 days prior to it being heard in the Senate, COVID shut everything down.
Wow.
So all of that work was for naught. Well, I shouldn't say for naught, because, you know, we certainly will be proceeding forward with doing some more of that, you know. But yeah, there's quite a sophisticated level of interaction, training, professional ability. Unlike in the rest of the nation, there are many states that are actually struggling and have no funding, have no way to create a cohesive effort, and therefore there's a lack of connectivity, you know, in the conservation world for many of them. We're very lucky here in Wisconsin. But, you know, like anything else, we're underfunded, you know.
You were saying before we went on the air that this notion of land conservation, I mean, maybe that's been around for centuries, I don't know, but a lot of what we are talking about today actually first sort of sprang into being in the 1930s in what we think of as the Dust Bowl years. Well, first of all, was there a thing called land conservation even before that, or is that really when the concept first arose, or the first notion that we need to be taking good care of, for instance, the soil and the water and so on?
Well, there really wasn't much of a realization that, you know, management for future generations was probably the number one priority. The Dust Bowl occurred in the 30s, and so Congress created the Soil Conservation Service in, 1933, I guess. And in 1933, the very first project in the entire nation relating to soil conservation was started in Coon Valley, Wisconsin. So Wisconsin has a long history and a very rich history of land conservation and management, land stewardship.
So you're saying that, in a sense, this concerted effort began in Wisconsin, right? The first sort of tangible project involving this happened in this state.
That is correct.
Wow.
That is correct.
I did not know that.
Yeah, history making, you know. And so, you know, you move forward to the 50s. Wisconsin Association of Conservation Districts was formed county by county. And it really changed the way that conservation was delivered in this state. So much so that in the 1980s, the legislature decided that they were that our state was tired of having to fight for federal dollars and compete with everybody else. So they created legislation that established conservation districts or conservation departments in each county and provided a level of funding, a minimum level of funding for that. And, you know, the minimum level of funding has never quite been met, and we are always fighting for those dollars, but the shortfall is made up by county levy dollars. in each county. And every county runs their departments quite differently. There, some counties in the north have, you know, 7-8 people working in the department, and they do an absolute ton of work. In Racine County, we have 3 people in the department, and we manage more acres per employee than anywhere in the state in Racine County. And Kenosha County only has 1 or 2 people, you know, working in their department. But they get a massive amount of work done also, and very impressive work, as Nan has seen, you know, and Root Pike Wind was involved in some of the stuff here in Kenosha County, the regenerative stormwater conveyance systems. Mm-hmm. Those are amazing, innovative projects that are just now coming online. This past summer, I brought some of the National Conservation District leadership here to view those projects, and they stood at those projects with their mouths open, speechless, unable to say anything except from Tim Palmer, the immediate past president of National Association of Conservation Districts, we call it NACD. Tim stood there and he said, "This is the way it should be done throughout the entire country."
Mm. Wow!
You know, and so that was a ringing endorsement.
Yeah, you know? Lavish compliment. That's great. When you use the term management, like when you're saying there's I think you said a staff of three in Racine County, mm-hmm. that's managing all of this land. Mm-hmm. How are you using the term manage or management? Management in what sort of way?
Manage the work that goes on the acreage. There are many different types of conservation practices. They're designed to control erosion and to increase water quality. You know, the days of farming a field from ditch to ditch, we're trying to eliminate that, you know, creating buffer zones, creating areas where there are filtering plants to allow the runoff and to grab the nutrients from fertilizer or manure applications, things of that nature, so it doesn't go into the watershed, so it doesn't go into the streams and end up in the Pike River and end up in the lake. So there's water quality issues, there's erosion management, and there are other practices that we're trying to change, such as no-till versus tilling, using cover crops rather than letting a field go bare, you know, for the off season. All of these things help keep soil on the land and improve the soil quality, thereby improving, in an overall sense, the viability and the usability of those working lands, which also in the end increases the profitability of that working land. You know, so there's a shift in attitude, it's a shift in focus that we're looking for, and all these practices that are put in place, grassed waterways, the erosion channels, the mitigation of soil loss. There's a lot of different things that go on there that need funded, okay, because many of the producers cannot afford to do it, so we have state and federal money available to help them. Oftentimes it's a cost share, but all of that has to be managed by our staff, you know. And then they get involved in many different things like water planting.
Right. Part of what is interesting about this is when you have Farmer X who owns Land X, I assume at least to some extent that is his land for he or she to do with as they please. I mean, it isn't against the law, I don't think, to not take proper care of your own farmland. And on the other hand, probably the typical farmer wants to some extent to take good care of the land from which they derive their living. But I mean, what is sort of the mechanism by which these good practices take place or are implemented? Is it just a matter of persuading farmers and other landowners to do these good things, or is there more weight behind what you do?
Well, there, part of it is done through legislation. Okay, we mentioned SITCOM. We mentioned the Standards Oversight Council, which creates administrative rule, you know, through DATCAP. Sometimes you can do a little bit of it through there, sometimes through state statute. Local ordinance comes into play in regards to manure management, you know, shoreland zoning, things of that nature. But the majority of it, is done through voluntary cooperation. And that's a huge thing, because when you're able to get a landowner, and it's not just farmers, you know, larger landowners or even somebody with a small lot on a lakefront, to recognize the fact that they need greater stewardship of what they have to protect not only their immediate environment, but the environment around them and people downstream. Mm-hmm. When they buy into that, it's amazing how passionate they become, and they're willing and ready to do the work, spend the dollars, and create those conservation practices.
I'd like to add, I think that one of the most important and effective ways to create change within the agricultural community is peer-to-peer. So when farmers can speak to one another about it, and when you have a farmer who has successfully managed his soil through cover cropping and perhaps other methods, and then comes to an area where farmers are just beginning to think about that, and he can show them directly the benefits that it has brought to him, you can then create sort of a groundswell, if you will, of people more willing to think about this. You know, farmers have done things the same way for a very long time, and it's really difficult to change those kinds of things. But when another farmer comes in from Wisconsin and says, hey, no, look at what this has done for my yield, look at the health of my soil, you can do this too, it makes a world of difference.
Interesting.
Changing that muscle memory is very difficult. It's but very a very difficult. Great example of that is what happened up here at KRN 31 with that regenerative stormwater conveyance system. That farmer, when Highway KR was rebuilt, he stood to lose a couple of acres of ground. But with the new project, he lost only half of that. He was required to give up, he was paid for it. But he didn't, you know, half of that amount was taken out of production. So it was a great benefit to him, you know, again, to work with the conservation department and Root Pike Wind and create that project.
And then by extension, of great benefit to everybody in the Root Pike watershed because of the regenerative stormwater conveyance system, managing stormwater runoff, again, which is not a waste product. We have to remember that. That's our water. Managing it in a different way than what has been traditionally done. Those are the wave of the future, I think. I hope, anyway.
Mm-hmm. For those of you just joining us, today is the monthly visit of Nan Calvert to the morning show. And with her today is Monty Osterman, who is chairman of the board for the Wisconsin Land and Water Conservation Association. And this whole notion of land conservation sprang out of desperate need in the 1930s in the wake of what is known as the Dust Bowl. So I'm just curious, and I know neither of you were around for the Dust Bowl and the horrors of that, but in a sense, as far as we know, I mean, the Dust Bowl, of course, was caused in part by drought conditions on a staggering scale, but coupled with that was the way the land was utilized. And so at that point in time, what was being done wrong? What was being done that, in a sense, was man's contribution to what we know of as the Dust Bowl?
Well, a lot of it was dealt with clearing the lands for agricultural use. You know, they cleared everything. They didn't leave anything to any kind of root systems or plants and vegetation or trees, even around the edges, to you know, hold the water, to hold the soil. And so a lot of that had to do with grading, you know, and this notion that, well, you know, you kind of referenced it, you know, it's my land, I can do what I want, you know, don't tell me, government, to, you know, get off my land, that sort of thing. And so that was part of it. And then just the over-tillage, you know, constantly turning the earth to a point where there's nothing holding it together, you know. And that was the two biggest things. And you know, what's interesting about it is that, yes, I believe in landowner rights, and I believe that people have, for the most part, the right to do what they want on their properties and on their holdings. But when it gets to the point where it's directly affecting the health of other people, then you got to kind of sit back and think about that for a minute. And that's what happened in the Dust Bowl. I mean, look how many, thousands of people died, and the effects of it were felt clear to New York City with, you know, buildings being covered in dust. And it was a perfect storm, sure, but it wouldn't have happened if that particular element, as far as, you know, the misuse of the working lands, was not there.
What's kind of curious to me is, it's interesting to me that there never was a so-called Dust Bowl before that. Or maybe there were, but they were of shorter duration, and maybe somehow that story just didn't get told. But I mean, I suspect that farmers didn't suddenly start to become foolish and greedy in the early 20th century, and then we have a drought and we have the Dust Bowl. It just seems like, or was that? I mean, were farmers beginning to do what they did in ways that were even more counterproductive than before?
Well, you remember what happened right before that. The Great Depression started, right? So there was an exodus from the cities, from a lot of the industrial areas, into the rural areas, and more people were using the land just to survive.
Okay,
you know, and they didn't know.
Interesting. So that might have been a contributing factor then, kind of a influx of, in a sense, amateurs that maybe led to some of this sort of excessive neglect of the land, and then, of course, catastrophic results. Mm-hmm. How is it that some of these better practices came into being so quickly? Or is this something that experts in the field, were there experts in the field that kind of knew all this, but it had not been implemented widely? I mean, it's just kind of interesting. You wonder kind of where did the expertise come into being in terms of how do we take better care of the land?
Sure. Well, you know, one name that you'll recognize is Aldo Leopold, right? He was there, right? And then later, Gaylord Nelson, who became a senator, you know, was very knowledgeable of the things that needed to change. So there have been people, all along, and that have been instrumental in. But, gosh, it takes 75 years, you know, as you can see, to start affecting these changes and the constant preaching of a different way. You know, muscle memory is very hard to change in some communities, you know.
Interesting.
And so, yeah, there have been people, but it as Nan alluded to, the most effective way is one-on-one, one parcel at a time, one person at a time, one convert at a time, you know. And so it takes a long period of time to affect that change. But now we kind of have seen a sea change, because there's a real saturation of information, we have more technology available to produce the data and the results, which are irrefutable. And so I think we just have more access to better information these days.
Interesting.
I wanted to talking about something that's a somewhat parallel to the Dust Bowl. So we now live within the climate crisis, and whether or not you believe it's human caused is inconsequential. The fact is that there are significant, substantial changes in what's happening. And if you have been paying attention, you know that quite a bit of agricultural land has been abandoned because it doesn't drain anymore. So flooding, standing water, rendering land, you know, no longer tillable. You can't plant corn, can't plant soybeans or whatever it is. And so it's imperative that we really jump on these kinds of things now and create buffer zones, as Monty mentioned, that, you know, not only provide habitat for other native things, birds, insects, and whatnot, but they also have deep root systems that allow water to infiltrate back underground where it's supposed to go first rather than sheet flow off. So there are a whole host of things that individuals should be thinking about, but also municipalities. And so green infrastructure is really important now. Replacing traditional landscaping with green infrastructure, incorporating green infrastructure in new construction, and so on and so forth, really, really important so that we can avoid this sort of crisis that we had, this sort of disaster that we had with the Dust Bowl.
That underscores what you were saying earlier, Monty Osterman, that once upon a time, this notion of land conservation was pretty much limited to rural areas and farmland. Mm-hmm. And now you're seeing more and more attention being given to the land in urban and suburban America as well.
Correct. Yeah. You know, the concept of the connection, the connectivity, you know, in regions or by watershed has come to the forefront, and people are realizing, you know, professionally and you know, the everyday person mowing his grass, you know, in suburban America are starting to realize, you know, the effects of what happens. We call it the downstream effect, you know. And so the whole idea of urban agriculture and urban conservation has been coming to the forefront. I've been very fortunate to be placed on the Urban Agriculture Committee for National Conservation Districts, one of my assignments. And we have learned a lot around the country with projects that we've been involved in. And, you know, the interesting thing is that here in Wisconsin, we're losing approximately 20,000 acres a year of farmland and working lands to development, to permanent erosion, to flooding, to even legacy loss, where, you know, they're not being reestablished from one generation to another. And the only place to put that back is in the urban areas or the developing areas where you set aside some parcels for to start creating, you know, an area that could be farmed, even in small scale, 1 acre at a time. Every acre counts. And when you look at a city like Racine that's landlocked, where are you going to do that? You're going to do that in the brownfield areas. You're going to do that in the redevelopment, the repurposed areas. That's the only place to do it. So the concept of urban conservation, urban agriculture, is hugely important for our future.
Wow. For just putting food on the table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about a couple of tangible efforts to conserve land, to keep the soil and the water healthier. Buffer zones is a term that's been thrown around a couple of different times. What are we talking about with buffer zones? And to the amateur eye of somebody just driving past, what would they look like? I mean, are buffer zones something that are visible and noticeable and obvious?
Oftentimes, yes. Well, actually, almost all the time. If you look at a farm field and you look around the edges of the farm field, if you see an area that's 10, 15, 20 feet wide around the whole perimeter, that's not farmed, that has some people call it weeds. I call it beautiful plantings, you know, prairie grasses and things of that are native to the area. Those are there for a couple of reasons. They'll soak up excess nutrients that would normally go into the streams and cause algae blooms and you know, toxic algae and problems that way. And also there to you know, start to soak up excess water. You know, many of these plants will take up 300 times their weight in you know, in water weight, and wow, release it back, you know, process it and release it back into the air. So, you know, there's some flood mitigation there also. Anytime you put something back to its natural state. Now, some people, you know, you see it oftentimes now, we're doing it more at the county, And you see a lot of municipalities starting to do this, where they're planting the ditches and the swales and along the roadway with filtering plants. And, you know, I have to laugh because my father-in-law, I love him dearly, most wonderful man, but he is adamant that those ditches have to be mowed because he just thinks it looks terrible. And when he drives up here, you know, that should be mowed. They should be taking care of this. And the fact is that they are taking care of it. We are taking care of it better than if it was mowed down and, you know, finely clipped grass.
Interesting. Nan, it seems like that basic concept has come up so often about what looks good, what looks beautiful, and we have these kind of careless assumptions we make about that, and often we're choosing something that at a glance looks to be pristine or lovely, but there's another story behind some of those practices.
Oh, a whole lot of stories that aren't necessarily good ones. I think part of it is that we aren't taught about native plant communities, native habitats. And so we don't understand them. We don't know what they look like. We don't know what their significance and purpose are. And then we're bombarded in the media with, you know, things that aren't native, but they look good. They're window dressing. And a little bit of that is okay. But the problem is, too much of it has now degraded all of our ecosystems, water quality, and just the amount of topsoil that we have. We've got to let go of that notion, of the sort of window dressing notion. And in my experience, when people begin to learn about native plants and they see them and they understand what role they play, suddenly I'll have people coming up to me and say, okay, I'm getting rid of my entire front lawn. Can you help me? You know? and that's a wonderful thing, because when we drive around and we go from neighborhood to neighborhood, it's just a sea of non-functional turf grass. It's better than cement, but there are things that we could be doing so much better. It starts at the municipal level by upgrading ordinances that so often work against people who want to do native landscaping because of archaic verbiage and all that sort of thing. And then again, it's just one-to-one. This is what they do. This is what it looks like. You'll have more birds and butterflies and native pollinators than anybody else. And so Monty's right, it's changing, but I've been doing this for a really long time, and it's not changing fast enough for me, but it is getting better. It is getting better.
At least there's a wider understanding.
I'll give you a quick story and a reference. Look up Water from Stone, and you'll see a story about a gentleman in Texas who took and paid just pennies for this land. It was the most arid, rocky, nasty, ugly land in Texas, and all of his farmer buddies made fun of him, and nobody thought he could do anything with it. But he had an idea that buffer zones and native plantings and things of this nature could restore that land, and it was completely unusable for anything. Nobody wanted it. Like I say, he paid pennies for it. And what the guy did was he started with the right types of plantings, and he started being able to restore the water table on that land. And then all of a sudden streams showed up, and then he had soil, and then he was able to farm it. And now it's one of the most pristine, most beautiful pieces of property in that area. And he's got school kids coming to learn all about how it happened. And it only took him 2 years to be able to start to see the beginnings of a stream. Two seasons, really. And, I mean, when you think about that, that's tomorrow in environmental terms, you know. So Water from Stone, you can look at it on the internet. Wonderful story, gives you great, perfect examples of how this restoration work can happen.
You know, that just made me think, cause you mentioned Texas just now. Wisconsin, as you've alluded to, has a very long history of conservation and important conservationists, not just Wisconsin, but to the nation, like my hero, Aldo Leopold. And there is, you can find it on the internet, and I'm sorry I don't have the website for you, but there is a Wisconsin Hall of Fame for conservationists. And it has who they are, their story, what they've contributed. It's really inspiring, and I would encourage you to Google that and take a peek. But mentioning Texas, they had the Lady Bird Johnson Wildflower Association. So she was instrumental in conservation in terms of bringing back Texas native flora. Which brings back your native fauna as well. So, you know, that's a wonderful thing. And, you know, you can find inspiration and resources just at the touch of your finger if you want to do this.
Interesting. And Monty Ashman, you said earlier something that I think is a good point to which to return briefly, and namely the fact that sometimes when we think about land conservation, we think of setting some land aside and doing nothing with it. I mean, that this is about leaving more of our land untouched and undeveloped. And I think you are wanting to correct us of that assumption, that this is not about not using land, but it's about using land wisely.
Right. Preservation versus conservation. Being politically involved most of my life, I came to the realization that one of the great divides between the environmental activists and those who controlled the money was that neither side could understand each other. And so a lot of what I do is try and bring those two sides together. I always look at the economic impact of any project, that goes on. Who's getting hurt? Who's not getting hurt? How is it getting paid for? Is it easy? Is it hard? It's important to bring those two things together. And I think oftentimes the more liberal side of the question is unwilling to realize that somebody has to pay for this. And so how do you do that? Whose pocket does it come out of? And the more conservative side of the equation, I think, looks at a lot of the environmental active groups as, being uninformed and tree huggers that don't understand anything. And they just want to put all this stuff over here and not have us use it, not let us have access to it, and it's doing nobody any good just sitting there, And this is the crux of the argument that I find myself in the middle of also, oftentimes looking at both sides of this. So preservation is definitely different than conservation. I said earlier, conservation means you use it, but you use it in a responsible manner. And that means it's funded responsibly, and then it's developed responsibly into either a development, with a priority toward green infrastructure, or it's not. So there are times when a project is not feasible, not viable, and doesn't make sense, You have to let further development happen. But most of the time, there's a happy medium there where both can coexist. And that's when you hit your sweet spot, and that's when you have everybody winning, and that's when we actually make progress toward a more permanent solution to these problems.
Yeah. Very well put. You've given us a lot to think about over the last few minutes, and of course that's why we do this.
Yes.
So absolutely. I think all of us have had our notion of what conservation and land conservation is both broadened and clarified. Monty Osterman, chair of the board of the Wisconsin Land and Water Conservation Association, we really appreciate you finally making your radio debut on the morning show and joining us today. We really appreciate it, and best wishes.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here, and happy to come back anytime you want me.
Very good. And Nan Calvert, it's always great to have you with us, and I know you're already hard at work on a program for December.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think we'll have a bit of a panel discussion for December, so stay tuned.
Looking forward to it. Nan Calvert, thank you for being part of the morning show. Appreciate
always
it.
My pleasure.
On Monday's morning show, we will be having our monthly visit from Dr. Art Sear, offering his analysis of current events. We hope you can join us. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock.